The following message comes to you from the pulpit of Macedonia Primitive Baptist Church in Ackerman, Mississippi. We invite you to visit Macedonia Primitive Baptist Church for worship services every Sunday morning at 10:30 a.m. Macedonia is located at 11 Staten Road on Highway 15, 5 miles north of Ackerman, Mississippi. For more information about Macedonia Primitive Baptist Church, you may visit our website at macedonia-pbc.org.
We'd like to continue our progress through the book of James this morning, and we'd like to consider James chapter 4 and verse 13, hopefully through James chapter 5 and verse 8. As you may know, the chapter divisions are not in the original manuscripts. And it really is a continuous flow, I believe, that we can go through this this chapter division, really continuing along the same thoughts. So, in James chapter 4 and beginning in verse 13, "Go to now, ye that say today or tomorrow we will go into such a city and continue there a year and buy and sell and get gain. Whereas you know not what shall be on the morrow, for what is your life? It is even a vapor that appeareth for a little time and then vanisheth away. For that ye ought to say, if the Lord will, we shall live and do this or that. But now you rejoice in your boastings, all such rejoicing is evil. Therefore to him that knoweth to do good and doeth it not, to him it is sin. Go to now, you rich men, and weep and howl for your miseries that shall come upon you. Your riches are corrupted, your garments are moth-eaten, your gold and silver is cankered, and the rust of them shall be a witness against you, and you shall eat your flesh as if it were fire. You've heaped treasure together for the last days. Behold, the hire of the laborers that you have reaped down your fields, which is of you kept back by fraud, crieth, and the cries of them which have reaped are entered into the ears of the Lord of Sabaoth. He that ye have lived in pleasure on the earth, and ye have been wanton, ye have nourished your hearts as in the day of slaughter. Ye have condemned and killed the just, and he doth resist you. Be patient therefore, brethren, unto the coming of the Lord. Behold, the husbandman waiting for the precious fruit of the earth hath long patience for it until he receive the early and the latter rain. Be ye also patient, establish your hearts, for the coming of the Lord draweth nigh." In verse 13, he again questions the readers. Apparently, this was a prevalent thought with some of the people that he was writing to in this epistle, these Jewish believers that were scattered abroad. And he says, "Go to now, ye that say." Some of you have this attitude that today or tomorrow we will go into such a city and continue there a year and buy and sell and get gain. Whereas you know not what shall be on the morrow. So this is kind of the language of a businessman. Now, I would say, at the same time, there's nothing wrong with having a one-year plan. There's nothing wrong with having a one-year business plan. But for the child of God, if that one-year business plan ignores the providence and your dependence upon God, then that is a faulty business plan. Because you'll notice this is a very self-serving one-year plan that he has. Today and tomorrow, we will go into such a city, continue there a year and buy and sell and get gain. Now, even if you have a good business plan, and maybe if you own your own business and we have one location, and you know what, I think we might need to expand into a second location. You know, there are so many things that are beyond our control in life in general, but even in this statement, you don't know that you might go into the city and you might stay there a year and you might buy and sell, but you don't really know if you're going to get gain. There are a lot of factors that would contribute to if that is the case or not. One of the main aspects of that being the blessing of God upon that endeavor. And you see, that's kind of the issue with the language that's used here. It's not that I believe it's very prudent for us to have goals, 1 year goals, 5 year goals, you know, whatever the circumstance is, but they need to be centered around the fact of an understanding that I am dependent upon the blessing of God to fulfill any of these things that I might endeavor. And that's kind of what he gets around to. We'll look at more in depth in verse 15 when he says, if the Lord will, you ought to say rather, if the Lord will, we shall live and do this or do that. Yeah, that might be a great plan for you to go into buy such a city, buy and sell and get gain. But you need to have an understanding of the caveat, if the Lord will, that's what we'll do, with the dependence upon the Lord. You'll notice this really prideful attitude that's exhibited in this verse is something that Jesus addressed in Luke chapter 12. Luke chapter 12, and then when he gives this, it's in response to what he said in verse 15 as he gives them a parable in verses 16 to 21. Verse 15 really sets the context for what he tells them here. There's a man that came to him asking for his inheritance. Will you judge between me and my brother? I want a greater portion of the inheritance, etc., etc. And then he says in verse 15, Jesus speaking, take heed and beware of covetousness, for a man's life consisteth not in the abundance of the things which he possesseth. In other words, the value for the child of God here in this world is not your net worth. It's not the possessions that you have accumulated over your life. Instead, what is substantial and tangible and the most important in the life of the child of God is laying up yourselves treasures in heaven. And what's so good about that? It's because moth and rust does not corrupt. And some of that language is going to come back around in the beginning of chapter 5. Moth and rust doesn't corrupt those riches, but the riches that these very wealthy people had been accumulating, it did corrupt. And then he says, again, he reminds them, your life does not consist of your possessions, of your net worth, of the assets that you've accumulated. And then he spoke a parable to them. And even though this is described as a parable, I tend to think a lot of times that Jesus described this as a parable, he's describing events in culture where the names and the faces are removed, per se. But I think a lot of times he's addressing stories that people were aware of, and he's using those as examples to teach lessons. I don't think they're just totally abstract to the people he's talking to, but that's just my opinion. So if that's the case, I think this might have been a story, a man who decided to do this that they were aware of, that his hearers were aware of, that he uses to teach this lesson. He says, he spake a parable unto them, saying, the ground of a certain rich man brought forth plentifully. And he thought within himself, what shall I do, because I have no room where to bestow my fruits? Now that's great. The Lord was blessing his endeavors to such a degree that I've brought in so much harvest, I don't even have anywhere to put the benefits that I've been blessed with. But then he says, this will I do. I will pull down my barns and build greater, and there I will bestow all my fruits and my goods. I have these facilities that are carrying housing, the harvest that I've brought in. But you know what? I am such a good businessman. I am so successful that you know what? I know I'm going to outgrow. I'm going to tear down everything I've got right now, and I'm going to build bigger ones because I am going to sustain this success indefinitely. And then notice the arrogancy that he uses, the language that's used here in verse 19. I will say to my soul, soul. Now, I talk to myself every now and then. They say that's not a good thing, but I think it's somewhat profitable sometimes. But when you're actually addressing your soul by the first person name, so when you're speaking to your soul, I don't ever say, soul, blah, 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 blah. But this guy did. I guess he thought pretty highly of his own soul. And he says, so he's speaking to his own soul, and he says, soul, thou hast much goods laid up for many years. Take thine ease, eat, drink, and be merry. In other words, not only am I going to tear down these barns and I'm going to build bigger barns, but the business is flowing so well that, you know what? I'm just going to take it. I'm going to retire and reap the benefits. Now, at the same time, there's not anything wrong with retirement either. Saving up in a prudent way for you to have substantial assets to care for yourself when you're not able to physically go out and work in the manner that you did as a younger person. There's not anything wrong with financial planning or saving for retirement. But if you have, again, this attitude that totally disregards the providence and the blessing of God, yeah, you need to save for retirement, but then you need to say, if the Lord will, I will be blessed to do that. I mean, how many people during the last recession that had 401ks saw their retirement plan literally cut in half? We don't have control over that. That's why we have to give caveats to these things. It's the Lord will, because we don't have full control over it. And if you really are honest with yourself, you realize there's very few things in our life that we have full control over, that we're not dependent upon the Lord to bless us in those circumstances. That's why he said in John 5 and 15 and verse 5, without me you can do nothing. Now, praise God, the caveat to that is Philippians 4:13. I can do all things through Christ which strengthens me, but at the same time, Paul said when he was preaching on Mars Hill in Acts chapter 17, he says, it's in him, in the Lord, that we live and move and have our being. You know the only reason you're still alive is because the Lord just keeps giving you breath. There's going to come a time when that's not going to occur unless he comes back first. But the only reason that we have our life sustained in the manner that we do is because the Lord sees fit to bless us. So this man said to himself, he's going to take his ease, eat, drink, and be merry. But he says, but God said unto him, thou fool, this night thy soul shall be required of thee. Then who shall these things be which thou hast provided? So is he that layeth up treasure for himself and is not rich toward God. Now, if you've got natural riches and you're rich toward God, that's great. However, this man had all of the natural riches, but clearly he was not rich toward God. But understand, the natural possessions that we have, they're fleeting. I mean, if you have any questions about how quickly those things can change, just go read the first chapter of Job. He was the greatest of all the men of the East. But within about a minute, he found out that he'd lost all of his sheep, all of his camels, all of his oxen, and he lost his family as well. But he went from being, if the greatest, I believe he was a very well-known and very well-respected person. I think that's some of what's being conveyed when he says he's the greatest of all the men of the East. But even if you consider him as the richest man in all the men of the East, in all the land, so to say, within an entire day, have you ever heard stories about people who were rich and then they went bankrupt? Well, I think I've heard that story about Dave Ramsey. I think that part of the reason why he has a little bit of credence. He's been rich and then he lost it all and he got it back. Well, that's pretty much the story of Job, right? He had all of it. He lost everything. And then the Lord gave him double on the back end. We'll look at him not too long, because he's an example of patience there in James chapter 5. But do you remember what Job said, though, when he lost all of those possessions? You see, we can not only, while we're still around, lose the possessions that we have, but what good are those possessions going to do for us if our circumstance is what Jesus addressed here in this parable, that if God says today your soul is going to be required of you. In other words, if today is the day that you happen to pass away, what good are those possessions going to do? They're going to go to somebody else. They're not going to do you any good. As the old saying goes, there's no hearse that ever has a U-Haul attached to it. I mean, we're not... Now, the Egyptians thought that they could take all of their possessions and I haven't studied enough about them to know what their end game was. I guess maybe if they're reincarnated, they'd get all the possessions they had on the front end and use them in the second life, maybe. But anyway, in their tombs, they had all that, all their riches there put in their tombs. And guess what? It's still there, right? Because what good does that do? If it happens that our life that's just a vapor happens to vanish away today instead of tomorrow, doesn't do any good at all. But what did Job say when he had an understanding that all this had been gone away and he'd lost all of his possessions? He was one of the most prominent, richest men in all of his area, and now he's totally bankrupt, doesn't have anything. And he said in Job chapter 1 and verse 20, he arose and rent his mantle, shaved his head, and fell down upon the ground and worshipped. He praised God, but notice the language in verse 21. Naked came I out of my mother's womb. Naked shall I return thither. The Lord gave, and the Lord hath taken away. Blessed be the name of the Lord. I showed up with nothing. I'm leaving with nothing. It's great that he blessed me with a little bit in between, but now it's gone. But you know what? If we have a correct understanding that the Lord hasn't promised us anything in this world except for food and raiment, then anything we have above that is what the Lord has given us and blessed us with. And you know what? If the Lord sees fit to take that away, the Lord, we didn't deserve it when we got it in the first place. We didn't. And God's righteous to take it away because it's His in the first place. It's His to give and do as He sees fit. And that's why Job was able to say, "Blessed be the name of the Lord. I'm thankful He blessed me in the manner that He did when He gave it to me, but I didn't deserve it then. And if the Lord sees fit to take it away, I can't claim Him as unjust because I didn't deserve it in the first place and I don't deserve it now." And that's how he was able to say, despite I've lost this great amount of possessions and wealth, blessed be the name of the Lord. So, we can't live in a type of dependence on ourselves with no regard for God. And even our traveling arrangements. I believe this is a very biblical example of this. In Acts chapter 16, I would say there's almost no one that would have been more in tune with the Spirit of God than the Apostle Paul. And then in Acts 16, when they were embarking on their second mission trip, he desired to go into Asia to preach the gospel. But the Lord suffered him not. And then he kind of recalibrated. He went to a couple other cities, and then they decided, we need to go in Bithynia. And then the Spirit suffered him not either. You know, he made a determination. He made a determination. I believe this is the path that I need to pursue. But however, that was not the Lord's will for him to do that at that time. Now, what's great about that story, he didn't go into Asia. 2 or 3 years later, you read in Acts chapter 19, and it says that all of Asia heard the gospel. God was not depriving his sheep of the gospel in Asia. It was just not the Lord's time for him to go there. And then, of course, there was later a church in Bithynia because that was one of the churches that was addressed in the epistle that Peter wrote. So both of those places heard the gospel. It was just not the Lord's time for that. He made a plan. He realized that was not in the Lord's will, and he recalibrated that plan. In verse 14, back in James chapter 4, whereas you know not what shall be on the morrow, for what is your life? It is even a vapor that appears for a little time and then vanisheth away. You don't have to turn here because I'm just going to read these, and and move on, but listen to some of this language in Proverbs 27 and verse 1. Boast not thyself of tomorrow, for thou knowest not what a day may bring forth. Well, that's simple, right? And so accurate. Boast not of tomorrow. Now, again, there's nothing wrong with making plans, having the calendar, but really, if we're honest with ourselves, that entire calendar is tentative. I was in public accounting for 5 years, and I told everybody, particularly during the different audit seasons and tax seasons, I've got a schedule, but literally my entire schedule is tentative. There might be a situation that occurs that I might have to, move this one to a priority list and, move something I thought I was going to do today off to tomorrow. And really, our entire lives are like that. It's a tentative schedule. And we don't know what a day is going to bring forth. And really, that's part of the reason we have to have an attitude of dependence and faith upon God, because, you see, He does have perfect foreknowledge, right? We don't. We can't see around the corner, but He can. And that's why we trust Him to guide us, even in paths that we might not have as strong direction about. I think that's conveyed in Proverbs chapter 16 and verse 9. A man's heart deviseth his way, but the Lord directeth his steps. You see? Yeah, we can make plans. Devise your way. And there's nothing wrong with that. But have an understanding that at the end of the day, it's the Lord that's directing the steps. And I'm thankful there's been many times that my plans were not very advantageous or good plans, and the Lord directed my steps in spite of the previous plans that I have made. Now, that's not to give some absolute statement that God's puppeteering everything, but the fact of the matter is He is in sovereign control of this universe. And if He sees fit to change your course, you might go get the proverbial whale to swallow you and shoot you in the other direction. That doesn't happen too much, but on occasion, it might. And He says, "For what is your life? It is even a vapor that appeareth for a little time and then vanisheth away." That word vapor comes from a Greek word that conveys the idea of breath. Okay? So if you want a mental image of this, I think it's supposed to get really cold tonight. I had on my phone that it's supposed to be like a freeze warning or something. Now, it may not have been cold enough yet for us to see this year, but what's being conveyed here is the breath, the vapor. We can't always see our breath when we make that exhale. But when it's cold, you can, right? You can see your breath, and I want you to stopwatch when that occurs. How long is when you make that, when you breathe, and that vapor appears for a little bit of time when it's so cold that you can actually see it? How quick does that vapor evaporate? Quick. I mean, second, two, second and a half, maybe. And that is the mental image. That's the word picture that's describing our life. Do you realize that? It's just like it's just like that. That vapor that appears when we breathe, that is just gone like that. And that's so fleeting. And that's exactly how fleeting our lives are. I'm sure many of you that are more progressed in age would say this even much more than me. You know, where have all the years gone? I mean, how could I have been around for 60, 70, 80 years or whatever? I'll be turning 29 in April. That's kind of how I feel. I mean, the last 5 years feels like about 6 months. I mean, it's just so fleeting. It's so vapory. Life is such a vapor, right? It just and the thing is, I want to give you some of the language. Again, don't turn here because we're just going to read these and then briefly move on. But I want you to listen to some of the language in the Old Testament describing the brevity of life. In Job chapter 7 and in verse 6, my days are swifter than a weaver's shuttle and are spent without hope. In other words, when that shuttle that they're weaving twine or whatever, it just happens that when that connects with that twine, it's just kind of like that. And that was the best context that Job had. And it said, the thing is that it's happening instantaneously, is almost what he's conveying there. And he says, my days are just like that. My days are here and they're gone just that quickly. Psalms 39 and in verse 5, behold, thou hast made my days as a handbreadth. And notice, this is kind of the distinction that we need to keep in mind. He says, mine age is as nothing before thee. Okay? Yes. 80, 90, 100 years here in this world. Yeah, that's a pretty long time. Methuselah lived 970, whatever. 900 years. That's a long time. But if we have the right perspective, how long is that in contrast to the eternal God of glory, though? See, God is from everlasting to everlasting. And in some way to convey to us the God's perspective, do you realize God doesn't even exist in time? He just invented time for our benefit so we could get along here in this world. He's not bound by time. He just created it for our benefit. And then there's going to come a time when time is gone. And then we're going to be right back to eternity, which is how it was to start with. But see, he's from everlasting to everlasting. And in some way to try to convey an eternal God to temporal creatures, we're told that one day with God is as 1,000 years with us. Now, that's not a formula, but he's conveying the fact that 1,000 years from our time, if you think the last 5 years has went by quick, how fast has yesterday gone? Right? Well, in God's mind, as the type of time lapse in our own mind, as from today to yesterday, that would be the equivalent of 1,000 years here on this earth. Do you have any idea how different the world is than 1,000 years ago? It's unreal. Absolutely unreal how different the life we live here today. But the thing is, God is eternal, and yes, 1,000 years is a long time. 100 years is a long time, but it's nothing compared to eternity. And that's what he's saying there. Behold, thou hast made my days as a handbreadth. Mine age is as nothing before thee. And I'm sure you've heard this verse, the end of this verse before. Verily, every man at his best state is altogether vanity. Even when we show up and even though a young child is not physically matured yet, I would say when that child first shows up, that is their best state. Because they start dying immediately. Now, just like as the flower doesn't totally fade away and totally crumble for many days or weeks in the future, our bodies don't totally deteriorate for a longer period of time. But as soon as that child shows up, he starts dying. He starts deteriorating. And even in that best state, he's altogether vanity. And we're just slowly fading away and passing away as the grass and as the leaf. Psalms 102, verse 11. My days are like a shadow that declineth, and I am withered like grass. You know, The shadow, when it's just a little bit past noon, maybe it's standing up straight. It's a little bit more erect. But then over time, it just slowly goes down, doesn't it? That's pretty much the way that our lives go. We might be tall and upright and straight at a certain time, but then we just slowly decline. And then he says at the end of that, that we're like grass, and we're compared to that in Isaiah 40. This is quoted quite a few times in the New Testament as well. Isaiah 40, verse 6, the voice said, "Cry," and he said, "What shall I cry? All flesh is as grass, and the goodliness thereof is as the flower of the field. The grass withereth, and the flower fadeth, because the Spirit of the Lord bloweth upon it. Surely the people is as grass." Now, I know we're just about past the point of having to mow for a few months, but think about that the next time you're mowing. You're just as fleeting as that grass that you just whacked down with that mower. That flower, yes, the flower of the rose might be beautiful for a period, but it's going to deteriorate, right? It's going to fade away. That grass might look pretty in the middle of the summer, but it's going to die in the winter, right? You know, we're just as fleeting as that grass that's just chopped down on a weekly basis when we have to mow the grass during the summer. And that is why, in James chapter 4 and verse 15, that we ought to say, if the Lord will, we shall live and do this or do that. The Apostle Paul used this language a lot in describing his travels. He would say, "I intend to come visit you," but, you know, there he even describes times that he intended to come visit him on a prior occasion, but it just plum didn't work out for whatever circumstance. And the thing is, you know, if we're making plans for the weekend to visit someone, go to a church meeting, visit family, whatever the circumstance is, yeah, I hope to be able to come, but you know what? The fact of the matter is, I could get sick. I could have car trouble that would hinder me from coming. I could have a more pressing issue that I have to change my schedule. A death, a funeral, if I had intended to do something on a Saturday, but a death occurs and I have to attend a funeral. You see, that's those things that we don't have control over. That's why our schedule is all tentative. And for that reason, at the top of that calendar, we should write, "If the Lord will," if the Lord will, we should do this or do that. In Acts chapter 18 and verse 21, Paul, talking about his journeys, he said, "But he bade them farewell, saying, I must by all means keep the feast that cometh in Jerusalem, but I will return again unto you, if God will." And then he sailed from Ephesus. A few chapters later, there was a prophet named Agabus that comes up to Paul and says, "You're going to be imprisoned. You're going to be held captive in Jerusalem. Don't go." And then all of the people there tried to persuade him from coming. And then after they could not dissuade Paul from going to Jerusalem, he said in verse 13 of Acts 21, "What mean ye to weep and to break my heart? I'm ready not to be bound only, but to die at Jerusalem for the name of the Lord Jesus." I'm willing to not just be held captive, I'm willing to give my life. And then when the people he was interacting with were trying to persuade him not to go, and Luke being among them, from the pronoun he uses, "we," when he would not be persuaded, we see saying, "The will of the Lord be done." We don't think you need to go to Jerusalem, Paul. We are doing everything in our ability to prevent you from going, but at the end of the day, the will of the Lord be done. You see? And there's many other verses in the New Testament that convey that same sentiment and that same language, that we are dependent upon the Lord. Mm-hmm. to carry out essentially any task. And not essentially any task. Because it's based on the Lord that we live and move and have our being. Again, that vapor of life, that breath of life that we have, it might be gone. And that the thing is, that's why we should live every day with an understanding, not just that we might pass away physically, but that the Lord might be coming at any moment. And that's another reason that I can't say definitively what is going to happen in a year, because I should have a hope and an expectation that the Lord, I hope, you know, there's a possibility I might pass away before then, but and on a much better note, the Lord, I hope, might come back before a year from now. And that's why we really have to submit. If the Lord will, we should do this or that. Then he says in verse 16, but now you rejoice in your boastings. All such rejoicing is evil. Do not take confidence and boast over the fact of what you're going to be doing in a year, 5 years, even a shorter time period than that. Totally disregarding your dependence upon the Lord for that to occur. Now, if you do that, he just simply says, I think we've learned from James so far. He doesn't pull any punches. He's pretty blunt. All such rejoicing is evil. And then he says, therefore to him that knoweth to do good and doeth it not, to him it is sin. Now, I hope that this verse strikes you as strongly as it strikes me, because as we know in the New Testament, to whom much is given, much is required. There's a lot of children of God, because God has a people out of every nation, kindred, people, and tongue that do not know the Lord's will. Okay? They don't know the way that they should be acting, other than the law that's written in their heart that they follow. But you see, do you realize? I would make the case that us here today in America in 2017, to whom much is given, much is required, I don't think anybody has been given more than we have here in America in the New Testament church. Do you realize how many children of God have never had this book to give them a hope, to get them through the struggles of this life? They've never heard men that were called to preach to expound this word unto. They didn't have the privileges of the kingdom of God and the community of the church to build up one another in the midst of our struggles here in this world. I cannot explain to you the benefits that we have here in the church and in the kingdom. The accessibility of the Word of God, the freedom to worship in the manner that we do. We've been given so much, and then corresponding consequence to that, how much is required of us? And how lowly do we live up to the equivalent of what we've been given? How much do we actually use that for the glory of God instead of just simply taking it for granted? Now, sin is sin. And if we do not follow God's will, even if it's done in ignorance, God still holds people accountable for that. But I tell you, the people who know about it, God chastises them a lot harsher when they willfully. Now, somebody might make a mistake in ignorance, but when you almost point your finger at God and willfully refuse to do what He's told you to do, He holds that person a lot more accountable than He does the person that's done the exact same action in ignorance instead of willfully disobeying. This is what we're told in Luke chapter 14. Luke chapter 14, Well, wherever that's at, what it says is, roughly, is that the servant that knew his master's will and did not do his master's will is going to be beaten with many stripes. But the servant who didn't know it, he's still going to be beaten. But he's going to be beaten with few stripes. But the person who knows about it, and essentially he willfully disobeys the command of his master, that master is going to hold him a lot more accountable than he does the person who don't know, who didn't know about it, and that for that reason he's going to be beaten with many stripes. And I can't remember if it's there in that verse or if it's referenced somewhere else, but that may have been where we're denoted. To whom much is given, much is required. If for how much has been entrusted for those that do know God's will, if we willfully choose to do that, we're held to a much greater accountability than those who do not. And I can't fathom the responsibility that we actually really do have to administer how much we've been given here and how pitifully we actually exhibit that. Because I would make the case that there is probably no group of the children of God that have been blessed greater than we have here in America in 2017 Primitive Baptist Church. And I can give you just days of reasons why. We have been given so much, but then how frivolously have we used what's been entrusted to us? And it's just terrifying to me to know how accountable the Lord holds us for how much has really been entrusted to us. We're just going to briefly go over in James 5, the first six verses of that chapter. Essentially, there's rich men that are essentially doing doing what the man there in Luke 12 was doing. They're just stocking up. They're putting all these goods to the side to save up for some future rainy day, saving for the last days at the end of verse 3. You rich men, weep and howl for the miseries that should come upon you. Your riches are corrupted. Your garments are moth-eaten. Your gold and silver is cankered. The rust of them shall eat your flesh as it were with fire. You have heaped treasure together for the last days. You've heard about these apocalypse people, right? That are so concerned about the end of the world. They're stocking up all these guns and meat and canned goods. And, you know, they're building bunkers and all this crazy stuff that, you know, especially now that the zombie shows have got so popular on TV, that's just took the apocalypse zombie people to another level, you know. Do you realize that's essentially what they're doing here? They are hoarding their goods for the last days. And he says, don't you realize all the stuff you're hoarding? It's going to ruin. Your gold and your silver is becoming cankered. Your garments are being eaten out by moths. Your riches are corrupted. Now, these were also engaging in some unsavory business practices. We found that in verse 4. Behold, the hire of the laborers who have reaped your fields, which is of you kept back by fraud, crieth. The cries of them which have reaped are entered into the ears of the Lord of the Sabaoth. That the phrase the Lord of the Sabaoth is not the Sabbath. It's a phrase that's referring to the Lord of hosts, the Lord of armies in the Old Testament. You've lived in pleasure on the earth and have been wanton. You have nourished your hearts as in the day of slaughter. You have condemned and killed the just, and he does not resist you. Then he says, be patient. And this concept of patience continues on past what we'll consider this morning. But he introduces patience. And what's interesting to me is he gives some other bullet points for patience. He gives the example of the prophets. He gives the examples of Job and later on Elijah. But the first example that he actually gives of patience, cheerful endurance, not just gritting your teeth and persevering and enduring, but cheerfully enduring in a joyful disposition, the very first example he gives of that is our expectation of the second coming of the Lord. He says, "Be patient, therefore, unto the coming of the Lord. Behold, the husband waiteth for the precious fruits of the earth, and hath long patience until he receive the early and the latter rain." If a farmer plants something, there is a set period of time. Now, he needs to be diligent in during the time that he's waiting for the harvest, but there is a set period of time that he has to be patient until that harvest shows up so he can reap the benefits of the fruit, right? That's what he's saying. He has to be patient to wait until the appropriate time to receive the harvest and the benefit of all the work that he's put in. And then he says in verse 8, "Be ye also patient, establish your hearts," strengthen your hearts. Because we know from 2 Peter chapter 3, there are going to be scoffers that are saying, "Where's the sign of his coming?" There's going to be plenty of people out there that are saying, "The Lord's been gone for 2,000 years. You've been saying he's going to be coming back." Do you realize that this was only written maybe like 15 years after the ascension of Jesus Christ? Well, I tell you, we've waited a lot longer than that. It's been over not quite 2,000 years, but it's getting there since he came back, and since he ascended, that we have been waiting on his second coming. But he told these folks who had only been waiting a short period, and we've been waiting a much longer period, which, by the way, again, that's not a formula, but just put it in perspective, that's about equivalent to 2 days in God's mind, which is not very much. But how much should we be anticipating the second coming of the Lord? Even these people were exhorted to live in a manner just like the Lord might show up today, tomorrow. Because what did he say at the end of verse 8? Actually, verse 9. "Behold, the judge standeth before the door." What he's conveying there is, it's almost like Jesus Christ is at the door. He's been at the door since he ascended. He just hadn't came in the door yet. He's on the verge of coming. He's on the verge of his second coming, and he's been on the verge of the second coming ever since he went up the first time. "This coming of the Lord draweth nigh. Grudge not one against another, brethren, lest you be condemned." And he says, "Behold, the judge standeth at the door." He says here, you know, don't hold grudges one against another. In light of the second coming of the Lord that will usher in eternity, what does one little bitty personal offense matter? Let's just be honest. What is small little bitty grudges and personal offenses matter in the fact that the Lord might show up today? It doesn't matter at all. In 2 Peter chapter 3, where he's dealing with the second coming of the Lord, verse 10, "The day of the Lord will come as a thief in the night, in which the heavens shall pass away with great noise, the elements shall melt with fervent heat, the earth also, the works therein shall be burned up." Again, all these, think about this in the context of the people he's talking about that are hoarding their riches for the good day. What's going to happen when the Lord shows up? Not only if you die, are you not going to get to keep the stuff that you have, but when the Lord shows up, that I hope that believers are anticipating, do you realize all the stuff you've been hoarding is going to be evaporated like that? It's going to be burned up with everything else in this world. But here's the point I want to make. In verse 11, 2 Peter chapter 3, "Seeing then that all these things shall be dissolved," in light of the fact that all the stuff around us is just going to be burned up at some point, "Seeing then that all these things shall be dissolved, what manner of persons ought ye to be in all holy conversation and godliness, looking for and hasting unto the coming of the day of the Lord, whereunto the heavens being on fire shall be dissolved, and the elements shall melt with fervent heat, And he goes on along those same lines. But do you realize that's one of the reasons, I would say arguably the main reason, if we are joyfully anticipating the second coming of the Lord, in my personal plans, why would I totally ignore the fact that the Lord might show up today? I'm not going to go into a city buy sale, make a plan. This is absolutely where I'm going to be at a year. Because I hope that I'm going to be already conformed to the image of Jesus Christ in a year. Be great if that was true. And then, in light of that, in light of the fact that the Lord is at the door, he's right on the verge of coming in, he says, what manner of persons ought you to be? We certainly don't want to be ashamed of anything we would be engaging in when the Lord shows up, but that should dictate our conduct on a daily basis. You know, it's funny when people interact with me and they, I guess, find out that I'm a minister. It's like they just change their conduct to a certain degree. And I want to be like, listen, I'm not that big of a deal. And what does it matter what you interact in front of me? The Lord, which is the only person that really matters, he sees everything you do. So why should it change with your conduct in front of me based on you knowing one fact of information? Don't you realize that the Lord sees everything that we engage in? And in that fact, if the Lord could show up at any moment, what manner of persons ought you to be in all manner of holy conversation? Our life is such a vapor. It's so fleeting. And I hope that we can live in a manner of dependence upon God, submitting to the will of God, always give that caveat. Boy, I'm looking forward to spending some time with my family on Thanksgiving, if the Lord will. And maybe the best caveat to that is if the Lord tarries his coming. If the Lord holds off on his second coming for a few more days, and if he blesses me, then I might have the opportunity to engage in that activity. We hope these points have been a blessing to you. If they have, we hope you'll give God the glory for that.
We thank you for listening to today's message and invite you to visit Macedonia Primitive Baptist Church for worship services every Sunday morning at 10:30 a.m. Macedonia is located at 11 Staten Road on Highway 15, 5 miles north of Ackerman, Mississippi. For further information about Macedonia Primitive Baptist Church, you may visit our website at macedonia-pbc.org.